You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, January 16th, 2014. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Tanner Colby, author of Some of My Best Friends Are Black, on his piece, how Saturday Night Live tells us something about the problem of race in this country. Also on the program today, Chris Christie. Where do you go to be loved in this country when you are as radioactive as Chris Christie? Why, of course, to the only place in the country where their governor is more hated than any other governor in the country, that, of course, is Florida. Also on the program today, GOP representative, I think, in Virginia, right? Wants to bring back legal spousal rape. Why not? It's been years since we had that opportunity. Democrats in the Senate, will they march this country off to war with Iran? We shall see. Meanwhile, Walmart, documents released on how they fight unionization. Meanwhile, the Department of Justice filing charges against them for the way that they're fighting unionization. Also, a couple of stories about Cuomo the Lesser. But before we get there, I got to say, that is not my term. I borrowed that from my buddy Kevin Baker. But we will get to that as well. Meanwhile, turns out freedom gives you a rash. West Virginia emergency rooms report that after local officials lifted a do not use order for many customers living in affected areas in West Virginia, the local emergency room said 101 patients visited the area emergency rooms in a 36-hour span ending yesterday morning, reporting symptoms related to exposure to tainted water from Freedom Industries' chemical spill into the Elk River. They complained of rashes, skin and ear irritation, nausea, upset stomach, and diarrhea. And meanwhile, state officials who lifted that do not use order advised that pregnant women who get their water from West Virginia's American Waters Charleston Bay system, drink only bottled water until we are really sure. In the meantime, for the rest of you West Virginians, West Virginian is just another way of saying guinea pig. So enjoy that tainted water brought to you by freedom. Freedom from regulation, freedom from inspection, freedom from those costly things that, while they may protect local residents, who who wants to spend the extra couple of bucks to make sure you don't have a chemical leak into the state's drinking water supply? All right, we got to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Tanner Colby. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Tanner Colby, author of a couple of books on Saturday Night Live, and his most recent is Some of My Best Friends Are Black, and a piece in Slate Magazine, or Slate Online, I guess I should say, SNL's Real Race Problem. It's America's Too. Welcome to the program, Tanner.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So let me, you know, I got it. Let me cop to up front by saying that I don't pay that much attention to Saturday Night Live anymore. I think to the extent that I've seen more than 5 minutes of it over the past 10 years, it was, I think, just the episode when Louis C.K. was on. But I came from a comedic background, and I found your piece really fascinating. Not the least of which, because 20 years ago I was on a Fox sitcom that was an attempt to integrate black comedy and white comedy. I don't think it worked very well, but it was an interesting experience. And so I found your piece really interesting. And, of course, it centers around the, I guess, the sort of the public search by Saturday Night Live to find an African-American actress for the show. Just give us a little background about that for those of us who are not following the workings of Saturday Night Live these days.
Well, I mean, the history of race in Saturday Night Live is a pretty fraught one. They haven't had too many black cast members, and most of them have not really stayed very long, and it's been a special problem for black women. Until Ellen Cleghorn in the 1990s, there were only two black female cast members, and neither one lasted longer than a season. And Ellen Cleghorn was a fairly disgruntled employee while she was there, the reports are. And then you had Maya Rudolph, who was, you know, probably, well, not even probably, but definitely the most successful black actress on the show ever. And then since 2007, there have been no black women on the show at all during the Obama era, when especially you, in order to be relevant, you need someone to play Michelle Obama. And this became an issue a few months ago when Kenan Thompson, one of the show's two black cast members who are male, said that he wouldn't do black women in drag anymore, as sort of a line in the sand to say, hey, you need to fix this problem. You can't just put me in a wig and avoid the issue of hiring black women. And it's definitely been a blind spot in the history of the show, and that's caused this whole dust-up where Saturday Night Live was called on the carpet. They had Kerry Washington hosted in November, and they sort of tried to poke fun of themselves for their lack of diversity, and then started this special casting session that took place over the course of the past month. It resulted in the hiring of a very talented up-and-coming young actress named Tashir Zamata, who's part of the Upright Citizens Brigade here in New York, and also two black female writers to sort of address the problem behind the scenes. And I wrote this piece for Slate because it sort of fell directly into my wheelhouse. I've written two biographies of Saturday Night Live comedians, Chris Farley and John Belushi. And then I pivoted from that that sort of genre, and wrote a book about the history of racial integration, which is a bit of a career shift that the marketing people at my publisher had no idea how to explain. I wrote a piece, based on my understanding of the show and also my understanding of race, which is that while there's certainly bias going on within the human resources and auditioning mechanisms at Saturday Night Live and the people who do the casting, in that Saturday Night Live, like anything else in entertainment or media or publishing, is really kind of a relationship business. And
I'm sorry, Tanner, hold on for a second. We just lost you there for a second on your phone. Go ahead. So, like any other business, it is.
It's like any other, industry. It's based as much on social capital and relationships as it is on raw talent. Like John Belushi, everyone would agree that he's an incredibly talented comedian, but Lorne Michaels didn't really care for him. And he wouldn't be on the show if he hadn't been friends with Gilda Radner and Chevy Chase and Michael O'Donoghue and all these people who sat Lorne down and said, no, you need this guy. And so having those relationships with people on the show is important. And just as a general rule, black people and white people in this country don't have a whole lot of social relationships. And the comedy worlds and the black and white media worlds are still very segregated. You have Friends and Seinfeld on the one hand, and you have Tyler Perry and, Wayans Brothers sitcoms on the other hand. And as you mentioned in the introduction, attempts to bridge that have been great.
Yeah, I mean, that was the part that I mean, indulge me here as I reminisce a little bit. But, I did a sitcom for Fox in 1995 called The Show, and it was written by the executive producer of Martin. In fact, John Ridley, who wrote 12 Years a Slave, was one of the other there was just a handful of writers on the program. And it attempted to do that. I mean, it was done by Warner Brothers. Warner Brothers is the studio. They at the time thought we were going to be the next Friends. It was I played a whitehead writer on an all black variety show. And the experience of doing the show and also just it made me acutely aware of how there were two different worlds. I would never see any of the guys I was on the show with at any audition ever. This was 20 years ago. But even my understanding of the black comedy on the show was just light years away from what my experience had been up to that point. And even past that, there is an incredible divide, I guess comedically, but this is also the comedy is generated from life experiences, and the experiences are so dramatically different that this bridge exists there, and your piece really touches upon how that socialization played out in the experience of the vast majority of black cast members.
Right. There are exceptions to the rule, of course, but the black actors who were successful on the show came from, or at least had a significant experience with, the white social world before they got on the show. And black cast members who struggled on the show, less so. And that's been true, in pretty much every instance I've looked at. In the book that I wrote about integration, Some of My Best Friends Are Black, the industry that I looked at there was advertising, because I worked in advertising for a long time, and there were very few black people in that industry as well. And I would go to all these diversity conferences, right? They would have all these panel discussions about promoting diversity and how do we fix this and so on and so forth. And they would bring out about a handful of, the successful blacks in advertising. They would bring them out on stage to, talk about, how they had succeeded. And there would be, dozens of, frustrated and, various degrees of frustrated and disgruntled, blacks out in the audience who were, upset because they weren't getting anywhere in the industry. And so, I would get to know all these people and I would, meet them and in the course of researching the book, And what I realized is I've got friends of them all on Facebook. All the black people who were successful in advertising all had social networks that were 60-70% white. And all the people in the audience who were frustrated because they weren't getting anywhere in the industry or couldn't even get a job interview, their social networks on Facebook were 80-95% black. And it's like, well, clearly there's a, you know, a social qualification that's required to get in the door. And the lawyers who were, you know, sort of trying to, you know, address this in the industry and possibly sue these companies for racial discrimination were saying that, well, you're discriminating against blacks who don't belong to the right social networks. And according to the law, that's probably technically correct. But in reality, the reality is that, well, perhaps the social qualification is just a prerequisite, because getting ahead in that industry and in media or television and these other places, it's about forming relationships. You're selling yourself. You're selling your talent. And if you can't form the relationships to get your talent noticed by the right people, then your talent is ultimately it's going to go unrecognized, which is a tragedy for people of color, that they have a much more difficult time crossing that barrier. Whereas if you're a middle-class white person who just grew up in that world, it just comes like second nature.
And to what extent, too, I mean, because on some level, both comedy and in advertising, you're also selling to an audience. And, you know, give me a sense of what that the audience, how that plays into it as well. I mean, you know, I mean, back in the day when I was, you know, I think attempting to write something for Saturday Night Live, or I was told that the demo was like 15-year-old or 12-year-old kids. And I was like, I don't have anything in common with them.
Right.
And one of the things I've noticed since the time of when I did that sitcom is that there, or particularly maybe around then, there was, I think, it was, UPN was specifically targeting, was doing a lot more, black shows. Presumably they had a bigger black audience. I mean, I wonder to what extent the audience is sort of also dictating what is being generated by either the comedians or, in the case of Madison Avenue, the ads, the products.
Right. Well, there's two different dimensions to that. One is what the audience actually does want, and two is what producers think the audience wants based on their, you know, shallow understanding of race and not really getting what the market, you know, does want. And so you get, you know, white executives who think, oh, we need more black sitcoms for a black audience, so they greenlight more Tyler Perry sitcoms. Well, a significant percentage of the black community finds Tyler Perry demeaning, and they don't want that. They want, you know, sort of a more urban version of NPR, for lack of a better word. You know, there are a lot of black people who listen to country music. There are a lot of black people who watch NPR and do things that we tend to think of more as white yuppie pursuits, and they want that kind of, you know, entertainment. But that kind of entertainment is too white, and they think, oh, well, this isn't for black people, so we won't cast any black people in it. And so there's a great frustration on the part of the audience of not getting what they want. And so I think you're finding it on the internet, obviously, with, you know, everyone can have their niche. You do find more, not necessarily high-end television production, but you find podcasts and shows, directed towards specific black audiences. It's no longer just, this is black comedy. Things are much more targeted than that. And it's getting better, and the internet, and as a democratizer of information and entertainment, is allowing audiences to pick what they want. And so people are getting a much better sense of what people do want. Whereas 20 years ago, it was like, well, In Living Color is for black people, and, Saturday Night Live is for white people. So things are changing. But it's a slow, fitful process. And unfortunately, the slowest and most fitful people are the older white gatekeepers at most of the major media outlets who just don't get it at all.
Yeah, and so, I mean, and so now, like, extrapolate this dynamic out to society at large. I mean, you have this situation where there's this attempt to create diversity. There's an attempt to sort of, I mean, do you even need to go further insofar as like sort of what we, I mean, it seems that there the genuine attempt to bring about some measure of integration is, I mean, you talk about in the piece is one part assimilation, but also seems to be one part also that the product, I mean, what the goals are of any industry or it need to also change on some level.
Yeah, I mean, you need, you need the audience to be integrated and for the programming to be integrated in a sense. And, you know, the social color line in America is alive and well. And, you know, pretty much all white people are on one side of that. And then within the black community, it's sort of really a decision. Well, which side do you want to be on? Do you want to be on the Yuppie NPR side or do you want to be on the Tyler Perry side? And there's not a, you know, and it becomes a dividing line of factions within the black community. And I mean, I could spend, you know, an hour talking about, you know, the systemic roots of all these problems because, you know, the culture bubbles up from the communities we come from. The communities we come from the housing policies that determine, you know, how everything is segregated and the education policies that determine how our schools are segregated. And then ultimately it comes down to how your parents raise you. Do your parents raise you in a, in a multiculturally aware way, to where you're sort of part of the 21st century or not? And what's happening now with the demographics of the country is you have, you know, kind of three, instead of a black, you know, demographic and a white demographic, you sort of have three demographics in that you have, you know, sort of a younger, multiracial, generational shift of young people who are totally integrated and they grew up together and they're fine with it and they don't see any difference and, they enjoy that. But that tends to be a relatively affluent group, right? Because in order to have the social mobility to integrate with different groups, you have to have at least some, means. Whereas then you have lower income whites and then you have lower income blacks who don't have the means to move up or down or to move up, you know, socioeconomically. And those groups, because of the income inequality that's happening now, are becoming even more isolated. So it's going to sort of become a three-way race, and then of course you have other groups too. You have, well, you know, Hispanic community that is in very similar phenomenon. So, you know, are we going to integrate into one group or become a nation of balkanized minorities who don't understand one another? And in a sense, kind of both is happening. So yeah. How that will actually impact, the media landscape, it remains to be seen.
I want to return to that notion of the balkanization, and we don't have an hour to go into the roots of those policies, but we do have some time. So, I mean, from your the work you did on your book, like what were some of those? I mean, obviously, some of the reasons for the sort of the pre-existing balkanization are obvious, but what were some of the sort of the policy decisions that have been made over the past 50 years, let's say, that have led to some of those to some of this dynamic?
Well, I mean, one, for example, I'll give you is an interesting one, and it comes straight from the advertising chapter, which is, if you remember growing up in the 70s and early 80s, black people and white people watched the same stuff. Everybody watched the Jeffersons. Everybody watched Good Times. Everybody watched All in the Family and What's Happening. Those are shows that, you know, everyone watched. And then, you know, obviously black people watched Cheers because it was the only thing on. There were three channels.
Right.
You had the, you know, sort of the balkanization of satellite TV and the internet. But part of what drove that from a racial perspective is, there were lots of affirmative action set asides for black agencies to produce black advertising for a black audience because, you know, blacks came into the industry after Jim Crow and they said, well, you know, white people have had, you know, 100-year head start here. We deserve, you know, government support to create our own industry, to market to our people because white people don't understand us. And the net result of that is that there were now millions of dollars, there were black dollars looking for a black audience. Well, then you need black programming. So then you, so, well, okay, we need to black it up and create, you know, programming that's specific to this audience. Well, what do you think? Oh, let's give the Wayans brothers a show. Let's give Martin a show. Let's give, you know, Malcolm Nettie a show, Eddie Griffin. And so then you end up with the UPN and BET and Tyler Perry and all these groups producing entertainment specifically for a black audience, as opposed to the Jeffersons and All in the Family, which is really smart racial humor for everyone. And that's how you went from the TV in, landscape was almost more integrated in the 1970s with Norman Lear doing that really smart comedy, and then you had these advertising dollars sort of cutting up the landscape, and then by the 90s, things were more segregated, where you had Seinfeld and Friends on one channel, and then you had the UPN on the other channel, and nobody watched the same thing anymore.
And so, I mean, what, I mean, was there an alternative? I mean, or is that a just, is that a step that needs to be taken at that point?
You know, there's a lot of debate about that. Ultimately, it has probably been to the detriment of, blacks in advertising and in culture that they sort of were marooned in these, pockets, ghettoized, and you could say almost. In the sense that, you know, black talent went in that direction and ended up on BET and Tyler Perry sitcoms, and they're not in the pool to be considered for Saturday Night Live, which is the stepping stone to major stardom and real money and influence in the industry, the way that it was for Eddie Murphy. And so in a way that sort of, you know, hurt them. But then at the same time, they would argue that it gave, black producers and showrunners and writers more opportunity to own their own material and create. So, you know, it's the opportunity cost of it. I would argue that it's been a net negative, but other people, the people with the vested interest in the black agencies and then the UPN and then the black shows and networks and who make a living there, they would argue the opposite because they obviously make their living, keeping that in place.
Well, I mean, I think to be fair, I mean, you know, when we talk about sort of what the counterfactual would be, I mean, if there was not, the sort of, specific opportunities, I mean, I think that, you know, I mean, I think that era of television was destined to go away one way or another. I mean, I think, you know, it was also sort of just a function of, there just ended up being a lot more money in there generally, not just for specifically targeted black programming, let's say, but as the money came in, it began to really impact, I think, the quality of the product, frankly. And
right.
I'm not, you know, we didn't really get many Norman Lear caliber shows once people really started understanding how they were going to make a lot of money in television.
Right.
And it's interesting. I mean, what would that counterfactual have looked at? I mean, if you see the opportunity cost, what is that sort of like parallel track that could have been taken at that time? I mean, because during that era, I should just add that during that era that we're talking about, you get Garrett Morris, who, you know, on Saturday Night Live, who, you know, you talk about in your piece, but it wasn't like, I mean, we saw it with the Jeffersons, we saw it with Good Times, but there wasn't, I mean, you know, Saturday Night Live, 75, that should have been the heyday, right? I mean,
right.
And I mean, I guess.
Well, that's the difference between Lorne Michaels and Norman Lear,
right.
You know, in terms of, you know, progressive, you know, attitudes on that issue. What would the counterfactual be? I don't know. But if you take away the subsidy for the, you know, the separate isolated black entertainment industry, if you take away the subsidy for it, then I think there's a lot more demand on the white power structure to include blacks there because they're not being put over in the corner. And then I think you would have seen more of a change at the major networks and in mainstream entertainment. That's a total guess and hypothesis.
Right.
I can't really say.
And you still have the same dynamic that you talk about, you know, literally with the actors on the show, you still have that same dynamic in the executive suites as well.
Right. Right. And, you know, what, things are starting to pivot back to the center now where, you know, you have Scandal, you have mixed race cast on Community. You know, it's a fitful process of sort of coming back to the center. But again, part of the reason now is you do have a critical mass of affluent, upwardly mobile black consumers. Because let's be honest, entertainment is basically a vehicle for advertisements. That decides right. what gets made. And when advertisers are looking for the type of black consumers that they want to reach, well, who do they want to reach? They want to reach upwardly mobile black consumers. And those are the most likely to enjoy something like Community in Parks and Rec and, you know, sort of more mainstream shows and not really the Tyler Perry BET end of the spectrum. And so the Tyler Perry BET end of the spectrum, now that it's been established and built up, is sort of like getting left behind in the sense that, you know, advertisers are like, well, we don't need to advertise over there anymore. We can advertise to black people on NPR because the black people we want are listening to NPR and watching, what white people watch.
And
for lack of a better word.
Right. I mean, so it's following the money. And I think, you know, there were stories a couple of years ago about how sort of some of the major marketing firms were like, you know, no longer worthwhile trying to target with your products sort of some type of mill. You might as well go big or go very go very low end, as it were, I guess. And that's
right.
a dynamic that we're seeing across society. So in terms of from a policy standpoint to achieve those ends outside of entertainment, give me a sense of what you think needs to be done in that arena.
I think the starting place for most of it is housing policy, because housing is still very segregated in this country. The lending market for home mortgages is still very discriminatory. And there's a premium on white real estate and white school districts that a lot of black people can't afford to get over. But that's where integration starts. It starts in elementary school and in the high school cafeteria. And if it doesn't start there, then you grow up and you're 22 years old and you've lived in a balkanized world, whether you're black or white, right. and it's kind of a hard place to start. So if you don't go back and address the root level, I mean, when you're talking about media and culture, everyone thinks about the audition process for Saturday Night Live. They don't think about the housing policies in wherever Sasheer Zamata came from 25 years ago. But that's really what it is. It's, you know, it's the housing and education policy 25 years ago that are shaping the people who create the culture now. So we have to, and unfortunately in America, we look towards the next fiscal quarter and the next election cycle, rather than 25 years down the road. But if we look at where we want the culture to be in 25 years, we have to look at what we're putting in place to shape the next generation. And that's really where you start.
And as an extension to the housing policy, on some level, it's also about the way that we fund education. There seems to be sort of a very non-virtuous circle, I guess, or cycle, wherein you have schools funded by property taxes, which are a function of property values, and it is self-perpetuating. If you don't have good schools in an area, you're going to have you're not going to have people buy into that area. There's no way to sort of break that cycle. Almost hand in hand, I think, with that housing policy goes sort of how you focus on developing schools, because on some level, that's what also impacts sort of you get such wide disparity in terms of housing values based upon the kind of schools in that district.
Right. No, you're absolutely right that it is a vicious cycle or a non-virtual circle or however you describe it, and that once those wheels are put in motion, it's very, very difficult to bring them back to center. And, we see that happening now with income inequality. How to reverse it, I don't know. If I knew, I'd be president, but...
Not necessarily.
Not necessarily.
In fact,
true.
I would argue...
True.
You may get president and knowing how to do it, but not necessarily genuinely wanting to. But right. let me ask you this. I mean, I got to ask you, like, what made you'd written two biographies on Saturday Night Live cast members. What made you write that book that had your marketing people at your publisher so confused?
Well, I had sort of painted myself into a corner. You know, when you're in entertainment or any kind of media, you sort of get put in a box and it's like, okay, that's what you do. And after doing two Dead Fat Comedian biographies, people are like, oh, you're the guy who does Dead Fat Comedian biographies, or, you know, sensational pop culture tragedy. And that wasn't really what I wanted to do with my life. I wanted to do, you know, write satirical comedy and interesting stories about substantive issues. And by knowing people at Saturday Night Live and John Belushi's widow, I ended up writing about those comedians. And those were two very, you know, I think important, you know, touchstone moments in pop culture history that had a lot of weight to them, how those two guys died. I wasn't interested in writing, you know, profiles of the Angelina Jolie scandal of the week or whatever, but I found myself being pushed towards that box, and so I wanted to break out of it, but of course I didn't really have the track record of doing anything else. And I actually went out to Los Angeles and I met with a TV agent, and I met all these TV and movie people for doing these books, and I thought, well, maybe I can, you know, do something in screenplays or TV shows or whatever. And I actually had an agent tell me that I should do something about Paris Hilton and Lindsay Lohan because he said, you're that guy. He actually said it to me, you're that guy. And I was like, dear God, no, I'm not that guy. And so I was like, I can't do pop culture anymore. I got to find something else. And this was during the Obama campaign, and I sort of had this epiphany one day that, you know, here I was voting for America's first black president, and I didn't actually know any black people. And I thought that was an interesting lens to look at this issue of how integration failed, school busing, affirmative action, fair housing, all these policies that were supposed to fix the problems of segregation. Clearly they hadn't taken root because I'm just a normal person. You know, I'm not from a wealthy background. I didn't grow up in restricted country clubs. I'm just a normal white dude walking around. So if there are no black people in my world, that clearly means that something went terribly wrong with how we were supposed to fix this. So that might make an interesting lens to look at the sort of the backlash and outcome of the civil rights movement. And so I pitched that to my editor, and I said, you know, I don't know anything about this subject, but to be a white person writing a book about race, ignorance is the only qualification that I need. And she had a laugh, and she gave me some money, and I went off to write the book.
It's interesting. I'm still not necessarily convinced that there is of that alternate route, and that we aren't still a massive work in progress. But it is, you know, when we look at Saturday Night Live, I think, you know, we're not going to get much further, at least right. In that context. But maybe hopefully in a broader sense, in terms of our culture, we will. Tanner Colby, I really appreciate your time today.
Thank you very much, Glenn. Thanks for having me.
All right, folks, and of course we will link to the piece and to Tanner Colby's book at majority.fm. I mean, I think I've told this story before, and I don't want to bore Tanner with it, but I will bore you with it. When I did this show called The Show, and just a little bit of trivia, it's not Name Drop Friday, but booked on that show, there were three white people on the show and about seven or eight black people. And I played the whitehead writer of a fake black talk show who was played by, I can't remember what his character's name was, Wilson Lee. He was played by a guy named Maestro Clark, who went on, I think, to at one point host Soul Train. And the character had a team of writers. One was Chris Spencer, who hosted, I think it was Vibe. Like, there was a talk show put out by Vibe at one point. There was a couple of other writers. I can't remember their names, but I think one woman was on, had been on In Living Color. And then the lead of the show, Maestro, had a posse that just hung around with him, made up of four or five guys. One guy who had been on Martin, another guy, Sully McCullough, who I had known because he was one of the few guys who had sort of also ran in that same circle of comedians, you know, the sort of alt comedians at the time that I was hanging around with. The guy who I brought on to the show, my character brought on to the show, was played by Paul Giamatti in the pilot. And Fox was like, this guy's just not right. And they didn't lock him up in a contract. They're idiots. And I was married in the first two episodes of it, which were written and shot before the show went on to air. And these Warner Brother executives, I swear to you, they thought that this was going to be the next Friends. I mean, I remember just I was walking, you know, the Warner Brothers studio is a huge lot, and walking down the lot, and it just seemed like out of the blue, like I'd have Warner Brother executives riding up to me on a golf cart, wanting to take me places, and you know, to the commissary, and I would be eating. Many times being behind line, and you know, David Schwimmer and what was her, Rachel? Whoever played Rachel, I can't remember her name.
Never seen Friends.
Talking Jennifer Aniston.
Jennifer Aniston and that type of thing. And so, the first day, so we had a pre-table read of the script, and I got the script, and I'm reading about it, and Wilson Lee's character, the sort of the Martin of the show, who was basically playing, you know, Martin in this whole sort of meta thing that was happening. Because, like I say, the EP of this show had EP'd Martin. He had this posse, like I say, and the names of the guys in the posse, like it was like T. Reginald Smith, and one of the names in the posse was this guy was Big Fruity. And I remember reading this before I went into the table read and just going, oh, God, what have I gotten myself into? This is so over the top. It seems almost like offensive to me. You know, it was talking about how, like, the posse had to get rid of their guns before they came on set. And I was like, oh, God, man, this is going to be what have I done? And we get to the table read and we're all sitting around this big table, and I meet all of these comedians who have done very well, but I've never seen them or heard of them. They're like working in a parallel universe, in Hollywood. And before the table read starts, the executive producer, who I think actually was or has gone on to have been the president of the WGA, I think. I'm not sure. A guy named John Bowman. And like I say, the guy who went on to write 12 Years a Slave was there, and another guy, Matt Wickline, and Larry Elmore, from who was on The Daily Show. He was one of the writers as well. And I think there was those four guys were the primary writers. Maybe there was one other guy. But so I'm sitting at the table, and I'm just like, about this whole thing. And Bowman, I think it was, says, you'll notice in the script we've changed the name of Big Fruity to Big Chewy. And I was just thinking to myself, that's not necessarily a net gain for. And he goes on to, and all the black guys around the table nod their head like knowingly and like, yeah, huh? And I'm like, what's going on here? And he announces to the whole table that, of course, this is because we heard from Big Fruity, who apparently was the lead guy in the Eddie Murphy posse, that he was not happy with this. And so they had to change it. And everybody's like, yeah, yeah, because you don't, I subsequently found out, you don't mess with Big Fruity. Because the guy is famous for going around with his gun and getting into people's faces. And that at the taping of Martin, and, you know, I had done At this point, I think only one other sitcom, which was All American Girl. But I had been to other sitcom, you know, tapings because, you know, that's what you do when your friends are on sitcoms. And our sitcom, and apparently at Martin, had a metal detector. And at Martin, apparently, like, there was a box of guns that they would collect from, you know, friends of the show, essentially. You can't go on the set with a gun. And that was, and I was just like, I had no idea. And the whole process of the show, we had one script where there was a prayer meeting, that I had read the script in advance, where there were prayer meetings before we did the show. And in fact, it was what we did before every show. We got into a prayer meeting, and it was something I had never experienced on a white show. Subsequent to that, never had seen it, never even heard of it.
So that's why we do that before the show here.
That's why, that's where I picked up that habit.
It was, I just needed context for why we do it.
It was also awkward for me because I was also, I think, the only non-Christian on the show.
But not only a non-Christian, but really an early leader in the war against Christmas. And
that's right. Well, at that time, it was still brewing.
A hater of the Christian faith generally.
And sadly, I think the network lost its stomach for the attempt to integrate those two worlds of comedy. And by the third or fourth show, it became just not nearly as edgy in its ambitions. I don't know if it was ever edgy in its execution, but it wasn't nearly as edgy in its ambitions. And but even still, after when it got canceled, I think I thought I was happy. And then subsequent to that, I realized this would have been great because I, for a brief period of time, the only people I would be recognized by were by African Americans. And it was just a fascinating, you know, I think I've told the story about hanging out with Chris Spencer and going back to his house in Hollywood during, you know, we would take lunch breaks, and an experience when a buddy has pulled into Spencer's underground lot, you know, or parking garage, driving a Range Rover and talking about how he's been pulled over four times this week by the LA cops. And he had actually called the cops to see if he could get a sticker on his vehicle saying, "I own this car." And the guy who answered the phone was just like, "Are you black? There's nothing we can do." I'm sorry, you know, like. And then the other funny part about that was Chris Spencer, literally. I was riding my bike from Hollywood to Studio City, which was perilous because you like literally almost had to go on a highway, and I was renting like this really crappy rent-a-wreck, and getting paid. I think at the time I was making like $25,000 a week, but it was so recent that I had been living on less than that a year that I was like, I'm banking this money. And some of the guys are like Chris Spencer, it was like embarrassed the way I was dressing. And I have barely moved the needle on how I dress, but he literally went out and bought me a couple of sets of clothes, like chinos and some button-down shirts. Cause he was just like, you gotta learn how to dress. I never did. But it was a really interesting experience that I think it would have been even more fascinating had the show. I mean, we were only in production for, I think, about 8 months, 6 months. I don't know what it was, but it would have been fascinating for me personally, and probably not so much for America. But all right. That said, we're gonna, because like I say, I will say this. I mean, this was also fascinating to me. One of my comedic heroes at the time was Chris Elliott.
And Matt Whitline, who was one of the writers on the show, had written, was good buddies with Chris Elliott and who had written on Letterman. And Chris Elliott did a guest role in the show. And I remember, like, we were, there was a scene where I walk into Wilson Lee's office, the fake host of this fake talk show, and sitting in his chair is Chris Elliott, and with his back to the audience, live audience, right? And he rotates the chair to reveal it's Chris Elliott. And during rehearsal, the whole, you know, week, I was like, this is, I got to remember to take like a pause because the audience is going to go crazy because, you know, like particularly even at that time, it's like, maybe it was after Cabin Boy. I'm not exactly sure, but I was just like, I just thought like he was like, for me, this was like Chris Elliott. This is like, this is, I'm in the, this is the pinnacle for me. And so that we're taping the show. I walk in the door. He spins, not a peep from the audience. They have no idea who the guy is. And it was just, you know, that night, I think we had pre-mixed store-bought screwdrivers in his trailer to drive him home. And he just said to me, he said, good luck. Good luck on this.
Pre-mixed store-bought screwdrivers. Yeah. That's the most bizarre thing I've heard this whole 50
minutes.
Yeah,
they came in like, I didn't think they still have them, but they came in like,
Jesus.
It was not glamorous. I drove him back to his hotel. I think he dry heaved in my car. It was all right. Well, folks,
Sam's pitch for keeping the show on after the ratings are bad to the executives. Like, I'm learning a lot.
I don't think I appreciated it because I don't think I was conscious of just, you know, when I got on that show was December, I think I got booked, December of 95. And I had only been a year out of Boston. And I had been in New York for a brief time and, you know, Boston was fairly cloistered. You know, I was literally a year from working 4 hours a day at a Chinese restaurant, 5 hours a day at a Chinese restaurant and living in a three quarters way house that was, you know, costing me like $250 a month with no bathroom in the apartment. You had to go down the hall and share it with the other people living in the building. And so I didn't realize what a unique experience I was having, in the context of Hollywood. I had no sort of experience in that world to realize like, I never saw any of those people who were on that show at another audition ever again. And, you know, the experience for a while I was there, I'd go into an audition room and it would be like, hey, what's up? You know, like I would, and it was fascinating.
All right, folks, enough. You just got a great fun half tease right here. Good incentive.
That's right. I should have saved that for the fun half.
It was great, though. It was a good.
Mildly fun half.
Advertising.
Michael cutting you off.
Right.
Usually way better. Yeah,
Michael's like saying, don't give it away for free.
Well, I'm the 47% guy on the show.
There you go.
Yeah.
All right, folks, you can become a member of this program by simply heading to majority.fm. Oh, I should tell you, we have done an update on the Android app. We've got an update on the iOS app about to go live shortly. Basically, primarily fixes some tiny technical issues we have. You'll see some minor new features, but the streaming should be all powerful. So check that out at majorityapp.com. Become a member today at majority.fm. you will help support the program, and as a bonus, you get another 40, 50 minutes a day, assuming I don't go too long in the free half of the show. You can also support this show by going to MajorityReportKickback.com. Click on the Amazon link, bookmark it, buy all your Amazon crap through there. We get a kickback. There's absolutely zero reason for you not to do that if you buy stuff through Amazon. If you don't, then don't. But if you're already buying stuff on Amazon, by all means, why not give us a kickback? JustCoffee.coop, Fair Trade Coffee, Tea, or Chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. All of these links, incidentally, available through the app on the support page. You can find other ways to support the show on that app or on the support page on majority.fm. The number is 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. Phones are in effect today. You can also IMS at majority.fm or through the app. Tomorrow on the program, Cliffy Schechter will be here. And the comedian Judy Gold.
Ah.
Finally.
Nice.
Until she cancels on me again.
She had a very legit excuse.
Oh, you see? Yeah. I think she was getting surgery.
Oh, well, that's ridiculous. Yeah. Never book her again.
she's pretty psyched because she cannot stand Chris Christie.
Excellent.
She's like texting me. Like, I was on Haze again last night.
Like, why don't you talk about this in the better half?
I will. Okay.
So committed to giving free content. I don't even talk over the song.
All right. We'll see you in the funner half.